Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Revere Radio Network. Well, actually, I'm so used to saying that, but this is a special edition. I doubt this will air on Revere Radio. It's a special edition because it's really for the not for the geopolitically minded or the conspiracy type minded. This is more just for Christians or the spiritually centered. Basically, this is talking about it. On the last show, I briefly mentioned me having looked into recently and for a long time been concerned about the idea of the Sabbath day, for one thing, being something that has been, I'm going to say, stolen from us because, I want to just point out my really quickly what I was thinking, my thought processes about that and some of the things that I used to make that idea and thought process, just to see if I am, if I'm logical in assuming that, first of all. And then I want to talk a little bit about the Sermon on the Mount and really just see what you think about what I'm interpreting there. Because, I mean, for a long time, I just read that and it doesn't make, I'm having a hard time seeing what Jesus is saying there because it's hard teaching. I've been thinking about it and praying about it and asking what it could be. And I don't know, I think I may have something on it, but I definitely want to just run it by you to see what you may think about my interpretation of it. And I also think that it's interesting because when I look at commentaries about the Sermon on the Mount, and it doesn't seem like even the people that I really respect are kind of whitewashing it or something. It's... I don't know. I want to know how wrong I am, really, and so I want to run that by you first, or second, rather. Let me first say my thought process that got me into this whole area, which was to do with the Sabbath day, and as many of you probably know or should know, that the Sabbath day, the seventh day of the week, has and always been Saturday, which is... literally Friday night sundown till Saturday night sundown. So all Friday night and all day Saturday is the Sabbath day. And it was a move of the Catholic Church to move it till Sunday, which is a solar day, and just a lot of other pagan symbolism to do with moving it to Sunday. But I think the reason I say it may have been stolen from us is because if you read what God is saying about the Sabbath day, when he first makes a declaration, which would be the Ten Commandments about the Sabbath day, he says, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days thou shalt labor and do thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord, thy God. In it thou shalt do no work, thou nor thy son nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor the stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. I don't know what he means by blessed it and hallowed it and what exactly that entails, but I would imagine it. We can infer that he did something special to a particular day, not a day that we choose. I know a lot of people would say, well, you know, as long as we keep one day to rest and everything, but he definitely says keep the Sabbath day and keep it holy. So he's referring to a particular day, and it's not like he made a law so he could punish us if we didn't do it. He's clearly saying there that he made it, you know, for us to be blessed by, that he did something special to a particular day and asked us to do something on that day so that we would, I don't know, receive it or whatever. And so and I think that Jesus makes that clear as well when he says, when the Pharisees were all on his case about healing somebody on the Sabbath day, and the Pharisees made all these addendums to the law that was very simple. The law was, you know, pretty forthright as far as I can tell. And so the Pharisees were just really nitpicking and doing it for the wrong reasons and for the glory of themselves and everything. And so they were mad at Jesus for healing somebody on the Sabbath day. And he said, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Okay, that's interesting because he's saying the Sabbath was made for man. Now, you would think of the way people perceive the God's laws today, you would think that it meant the Sabbath was made to give man something to do, so he would have to do it, and, you know, or get punished. But no, he's saying the Sabbath was made for man, which, and you know, says that it's, you know, that there's something to be received by and from the Sabbath. Also, I want to point out just on another part of the Sabbath day, interesting thing is that the Sabbath of the land, I think, illustrates two things about it that I want to make a point about. The Sabbath of the land, God also said that there should be a Sabbath of the land, and that is that every seventh year that you do not plow or work the land, and anything that grows on the land you won't eat. So basically, the land also gets the rest. There's probably something to do molecularly, I don't know, where every 7 years or every 7 days for us, we need a rest. And I'm sure that on one level, our bodies won't function right unless they have that day of rest. Okay. I'm sure that that is true. Just like the soil will, if you don't give the Sabbath of the land, the soil won't be right. It won't create its own natural pesticides. It won't be rich. It won't have, you know, now today we have all these chemists coming around and taking samples of soil and saying, oh, well, you're going to need this chemical and that chemical and this chemical and that chemical and this one and that one and just a little bit of this and take some of this out in order to get the soil to where it will work, because we no longer practice the Sabbath of the land. And God was so apparently serious about the Sabbath of the land that, and the Jews did not keep the Sabbath of the land for some odd years. I can't remember how many it was, but it was a multiple of 70, because he basically said, okay, now you guys owe me 70 years for not keeping the Sabbath of the land. And so he put them in prison in Babylon for 7 years to the day to pay their debt for that land. So, okay, so, well, let's just look at that and say that we definitely need a day. So I'm saying in that regard, you could probably make Wednesday your day of rest, and your body might continue to work as if, just as if you had rested on the seventh day. That part may be true, and it also may be true that you know, we need a day set aside for worship and study and stuff, and that could also be I don't know, Tuesday. You could do that and probably get the same benefits. And so I think the arguments that, you know, as long as you set aside a day to not work and to do this and that, then you're going to be all right. It's like, you're probably right in that sense. But there's also, you know, like, God seems to do many things in one thing. You know, he's got, it's multitasking times, you know, 300,000. I mean, we have to say, this was an argument that I was saying to somebody the other day that was saying, well, you know, that, you know, you can just pick any day, but that's kind of assuming that you know what he was doing when he blessed and hallowed this particular day. That's kind of assuming that you already know what there is to get, and you know that it's good. You can do it any old day. And so I think that in a sense that somebody somewhere knew what we could get and attain just by doing it. And I think that there's another point about, let me finish that point. And so that's why they changed it to Sunday, to make sure that there wasn't a possibility of us figuring it out and being blessed in that way. So anyway, I guess to finish that part of that thought is that I think that the seventh day is important for a reason that we can't assume that we know. And it appears that, I can't point you to the scripture on this. I just remember hearing in my studies about this one, here in the last few days, that the Sabbath is almost like the wedding ring. It's almost like a symbol of the marriage, and so I think in that regard that it's highly esteemed. And if you look at the Ten Commandments, I don't know if God ordered those in order of importance, but it definitely is, you know, above some serious sins that we now consider that we wouldn't do. Oh goodness, we wouldn't claim, well, we're under the law for murder, but it's above murder to keep the Sabbath day holy. And that brings us to another point about the Sabbath day before we even get to the meat of this thing, which is the point about it is, there is obviously some manner of picking and choosing. I agree with us 100% that that the law cannot be attained by us, and so therefore we need the grace of God, the sacrifice, in order to save us, because the sin, because the law is a yoke we cannot bear, nor we nor our fathers. So, okay, I'm with you on that, and but my problem is that it just seems like all throughout the New Testament and the Old Testament alike, it's pleading with us and telling us and trying to teach us to not sin. I mean, it's all about don't, you know, the attempting of not sinning is important. And so what would we even do if it wasn't for the law? I mean, how would we have any concept of what sin was or wasn't if there wasn't a law to abide by? And so you can't, and I understand that the law being written on your hearts is not different than the letter of the law that is written down. It's just in a sense that you want to do it. Now that it's in my heart, it's no less, it's exactly probably verbatim what the law is, you know, not the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law. But but the difference between the letter and the spirit would be the difference between the Pharisees, who were living about as close to perfect from the law point of view, but without the reasoning behind why you would do it. And I think let's just move on here. This is the reason I want to talk about the Sermon on the Mount is because most of all, with the messianic type Christians who are, and you know, the Seventh-day Adventists alike, and people that are trying to prove the point about the Sabbath, most of the, you know, they use a lot of this particular verse from the Sermon on the Mount, which is Matthew chapter 5, verse 17, when Jesus says, "Think not that I come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, not one jot or tittle shall in no wise pass from the law, till all be fulfilled. Whosoever therefore shall break one of the least commandments shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever shall do and teach them the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." And, you know, that definitely shows that Christ was making a point to say, not even until heaven and earth pass away, and we can be sure that heaven and earth pass away, has not passed away. So, you know, the law is very much in effect. Now, let me talk a little about this. And so what I wanted to do was I wanted to take that in context of the Sermon on the Mount, because the Sermon on the Mount has a lot of hard teaching in it, and something that I think that even when I'm looking at the other commentators on it the past few days, I don't agree with very many of them on certain things. It just seems like they whitewash some of it and skip past the hard parts, because, you know, Jesus is making some hard teaching, as his disciples once called it. So let me try to take some of it in context and see what we can find out. Again, I'm totally not saying that I'm right here. I'm just asking to see if you know, you guys can point out any major flaws in it, because, you know, I want to know if you know, I'm trying to figure this out. So I thought, and I've been praying about this to figure it out. So maybe we'll see if I have any insight on this. Okay, first of all, he's talking about blessed are the poor in spirit, and he goes through these beatitudes, I think is what they called them, is basically describing the nature of Christians, what Christians should be like in their heart. And blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Mourning, I in the sense of, like, you know, are truly sorry for their sins, etc., and, you know, are very repentant about it. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. You know, that makes sense. They're the people that are can be taught, not afraid to say that they're wrong when they're wrong, and you know, willing to be taught. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. You know, it's a genuine desire for it. And these are all matters of the heart. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Okay, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. Ye are the salt of the earth, but if your salt have lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? And I think this is an important point, that the salt in that day, this is another point of God making, you know, 8 points with one illustration. The salt of the earth was something that did not, I mean, at the time was used to prevent decay and to preserve meat, which, you know, the idea of it preserving decay, it would not stop decay, but it would prevent it. The decay of this world because of evil in it, it would not, we are the salt of the earth in that reason. We are preventing the decay while we're here. But also we give it flavor and, you know, those kind of things. I've heard different commentaries on this, use all kinds of different things, and there are valid, I'm sure. But you're the light of the world. A city that is set on the hill cannot be hid. And neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your good light shine before men, and they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Now the next part is I don't know if it's contested. I think it's just not. It's just overlooked by people saying that we're not under the law anymore. Now it's important. I want to read something from a commentator that I really like. I guess his name was something Pink. He was born in the 1800s, died in 1952, I think. I can't remember, but I really like his commentary, not because I agree with it, but because it's like logical and very intelligent, and it seems like he was in his own self a renegade in it. But this is one paragraph. He's got a lot of paragraphs on this. This is a lot to say. I'll put links to this on the show. It says, "The manifestation of Christ in Israel's midst was sudden and startling. The first 30 years of his life on earth had been lived in private, and outside his own immediate circle he seemed to have attracted little attention. But as soon as he appeared on the stage of public action, this was altered. The eyes of all were fixed on him, and the leaders of the nation were compelled to take notice of him. His meekness and lowliness at once distinguished him from those who sought the praise of men. His miracles of healing soon became heralded far and wide. His call to repentance and proclamation of the gospel, Mark 1:15, made people wonder what was the real character and design of his mission. Was he a revolutionary? Was it his purpose to overthrow the existing order of things? What was his attitude towards the scriptures, and particularly the laws of Moses? Did he disavow their divine authority? These were questions agitating the minds of men and calling for clear answers." Okay, I think that kind of sets the stage for what Christ is saying here next. Everybody, you know, John the Baptist and everybody else, he's saying, you know, they're all saying, what's this guy teaching? You know, is he teaching against the law of Moses? I mean, you know, because he's preaching the forgiveness of sins. He's preaching, you know, this, and it's just revolutionary. And they're all, you know, used to the laws of Moses and what the Pharisees have been taught in the culture in that day. And the Pharisees have propagated this whole thing about they better do it exactly to the letter of the law like they're doing, or they're just not good enough and all this other stuff. So people were murmuring and saying that kind of thing. And here Christ is answering them and saying, "Think not that I come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, not one jot or tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled." Now here he's basically saying the law is immutable. No, I'm not saying the law is coming to destroy it. I'm saying that you're right. It is, cannot be. It's immutable. It's until heaven and earth pass. Now I know that a lot of people want to try to make till heaven and earth pass means till his death and resurrection, but I mean, that's a big leap of faith, in my opinion. That's definite. I mean, he's being very clear here, and I think that's why people have trouble with the rest of this sermon, is because he's being so clear and saying, till heaven and earth pass, not one jot or tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Now, till all be fulfilled there could mean, and I think does possibly mean, that till all be fulfilled, till he dies and resurrected, you know, but the heaven and earth pass, you know, and all that stuff. So So he's saying, whoever shall break the least of these commandments and shall teach men to do so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever should do and teach them the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Now, now this is what he does to prove how serious he is about the law. He's like, you think that that I'm against the law? It's like, I am very pro the law. In fact, I'm more pro the law than the law thinks. He says, you've heard it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whoever shall kill shall be in danger of judgment. But I say unto you, that whoever is angry with his brother without cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever shall say unto his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of the fires of hell. And he goes on to say, you know, about other things. He basically says, you say that, you know, that the law says that you shouldn't commit adultery. But I say, if you even look at another woman, you've committed adultery with her. So he's saying, you think I'm not about the law. I am way about the law. I am crazy about the law. I am law, 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 law. I think, and I even think it's a matter of a heart, not a, just a mere matter of action. It's a matter of thinking it, or it's a matter of, you know, it's like the C.S. Lewis said in regards to part of this. He said, I say, if you look at a plate of bacon and eggs with lust, verily I say unto you that in your heart you've already committed breakfast. And I think that it's basically saying that, you know, yeah, he's very, very pro the law. And just in case they're, but I think that they're, and then he goes on to say this stuff that people have a hard time with. And that is obviously saying, and if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of the members should perish, and the whole, than not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand offendeth thee, cut it off and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not the whole body should be cast in the hell. It has been said, so that's some pretty extreme stuff. And not only is he saying that, yes, I'm really against the law, he's saying, I mean, you had better avoid doing any of this stuff. We have got to really avoid doing it. And then, just in case there's any question about whether what he could be meaning, at the end of this verse he says, be therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. Okay, now, that's kind of the clincher. That's what he's saying at the end of this section. He goes on, obviously, to preach more on the Sermon on the Mount. But, okay, so he's saying something there, to saying, be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. So he's saying, you know, this is not something that you can do. It doesn't mean that he doesn't say how serious it is for you to do it. Yes, it is very serious. The law is absolutely true, and you're going to be punished for it. It's better for you to, you know, cut your hand off than to, you know, let yourself sin. He's saying, I am very, very, very serious. And then by saying that at the end, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, he's saying, I think that he knows that you can't do it as well. And, you know, I think that that's important, obviously, important part of that, because it puts the rest of it in perspective. And now, I think that just as something I want to interject here, potentially this is put a Acts 17:11 point into this, which basically says that, you know, search the scriptures daily to make sure these things be so, and do not just believe it because somebody said it. But anyway, I just want to point out and say as a possibility that, you know, the whole thing is that not that we would be free from the law, but that we would desire to do it to the letter and strive to do it to the letter. And the journey is, in fact, trying to do it. We will slip up. We can't be perfect. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try with all our hearts to be so. It's just a safety net for us that to be caught in. It's knowing that we couldn't do it. So he has put a net for us that will catch 100% of us. But it's like life is the journey. Life is the the attempt to be 100%, you know? I mean, it's not going to be done, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. It's like strengthening a muscle. It's like, it's just like strengthening a muscle. It's like doing an exercise by obedience is strengthening something in us that will carry on after this life. It's like we are not in this for what will happen at this life. This is like boot camp or something. I don't know. Maybe it's not, but I think that this is just my personal opinion that this is some kind of, you know, I mean, we're learning here. We're learning how to be, whether we like it or not, we were built to be eternal, eternal beings. And so I think that, what does it say? That, you know, we must put on eternal clothing or something like that. Whether we're good or bad, you know, we're eternal beings. And I think that this idea of trying to do this is trying to follow the law is what this is about. And to just pick and choose which ones we don't isn't necessarily bad, and that net is still there to catch you. But I don't think that in that case you've let, if the Spirit was truly guiding you with all its might, you know, or I don't know if that's a good way to look at it, but I guess the point is that the Spirit will make you want to be obedient. And if you look through the Psalms and all through the different times, you can sympathize with something if you're close to this. It's this desire, and your law is my delight, and being obedient to you is my joy. That is a concept that is so far from being able to be understood by somebody that is not holding the Spirit of God. I don't think that the Spirit of God is holding you. I don't think that it's possible to understand that concept, but it seems clear the further you go into it. And let's see here. Okay, and I just want to say, because I know that there will be a lot of people saying, you know, but the law and everything else, just in case there's any confusion about this, I think that Jesus himself couldn't have been any more clear all throughout the Gospels that, you know, all you had to do was believe in him. I mean, he said it over and over and over again in various ways and shapes and forms that all you have to do is believe in him. I am down with it. Okay, I am so okay, and I'm not saying that there is anything else that we have to do. It's very clear that he was as clear to that as he could be. But to say that the law is gone, the law is immutable, the law, it would take so much away from the perfection of what God said. And the law, I mean, even if the earth is gone, the only thing left might be the law. I mean, it is really perfect. It's a perfect thing. And I think that there is a really interesting study about what he does say in Matthew 5 when he says, you know, I came not to destroy, but to fulfill. And if you take a really break down what those words mean, it's a very interesting study. And I'll leave that up to you, but it's definitely out there. But, you know, yeah, my point is that he's definitely saying that is the only thing you have to do. If there's any other works where I've given you that impression that that's what I'm saying, then I'm not, then I'm wrong. You're wrong, and I'm wrong. But, yeah, so let's not think that. I just think that there is another step to it. You know, it's a maturity level issue that I think comes with being blessed, and it's something that you want. And then but it also is a responsibility for those that understand what he is saying and meaning. I think that there's different ideas and levels for this. But I do think, and I am a little concerned, that here in these last days, the teaching of this has gone crazy, and it is serving to drive it away. This very laws nailed to the cross idea as the only thing being preached. Like, for instance, I was in Knoxville, Tennessee a few weeks ago with the band, and there was a street preacher. He was a man that that I took very much odds with. This is even before I even really felt too strongly about any of this, but he was basically a blinking sign for, it was a real happening district in Knoxville, as the old city, as they call it, but he's right in the corner, and he was just a fire and brimstone type preacher guy that was doing, was it, like I said, he was a blinking sign just saying, here, this is what Christians are like. Don't be a Christian. They are crazy, and you don't want any part of this, you know? So I went up to him, and he told me, you know, his spiel about everything. And I forget how it came up, but it was my hair. I had long hair. I still do have long hair. And he told me that, well, I forget how it came up, but he said that I wasn't going to heaven or something like that, or I don't know. Yeah, it came later, but he said, name somebody in the Bible that had long hair. And I knew he probably wouldn't get away with saying Jesus, so I said Samson, which I can document. But anyway, he just didn't know what to do. Oh, no, his argument to the Samson thing was, oh, so you think that the New Testament and the Old Testament are the same thing? You could just put them in a blender and blend it up, and there it'll be. And it's like, and you just have one book. And I just was really incensed with him. And I just on a side note, I think that he was COINTELPRO in a real sense. He had a glaze in his eye that I was sure was either he was really, really drunk or something, but it had an evil glaze to it. I think that he was demonized in some aspect, which I mean, I don't know how crazy you think that sounds, but a lot of people like that are multiples, and they have been part of, one of their personalities has been demonized. It's very, very common. I hope and pray that we can all find out how common that is very soon. But he kept talking about a particular organization, which I happen to know is a cult that is affiliated with military individuals. And he not only had tracks for, you know, the Christian tracks, but also military, different branch of the military. So my contention, on a side note, I didn't mean to get off on this too much, but that's the kind of stuff that they're doing, that they're sending out these mind-controlled drones to go make people think Christianity is this ridiculously ugly thing. And he was just, you know, just pounding people in the middle of the streets of all this stuff, just calling them out and telling them they weren't, you know, whatever, whatever. But my point is, one of the things that I didn't like about him, really made me think about it for the first time, really thought that this is not something I want, is this whole idea that, he was pushing the law was dead. And it just at that time hit me as something that wasn't godly. And I know that it's not dead in any sense that we perceive it. I mean, I know that if it was dead, then there would be no concept of sin. I mean, there is no sin apart from the law. It's very important that we understand that the law can't be dead, because we would have no barometer to know if we were doing good or not. I mean, how would we even know what good was if it wasn't for the law? And I submit that if the creator of the universe wanted to make the laws reversed and what is good, bad, and bad, good, then that's the law that we would have to follow regardless. I mean, he put it in our hearts to want good and to hate bad. He could have just as easily put it in our hearts to want bad and hate good. What's the difference in definitions if our hearts change to want the other one and naturally? You know, I mean, C.S. Lewis spent, you know, and C.S. Lewis has his flaws, but obviously, but you know, I mean, he spent much of his apologetic ministry just explaining that fact, that there's no, you know, that we would have no concept of dark if we didn't have eyes, if there was no light. I mean, the dark would be without meaning, and, you know, various ways to discuss that and illustrate that point. Okay, so I guess I'm done here. I got more to I got more to say. Oh, you know what? I do want to say something about this. At the end of Matthew, you know, after Jesus dies and is resurrected, and, you know, I've been looking at the end of the Gospels just to kind of see what kind of things he was saying after he died and was resurrected, because, you know, you'd think right then is when he would say something like, and now the law is no longer, you know, all the sins are, you don't have to do the law anymore, is what I would think, you know, if we're going to, because all throughout the rest of his ministry, he does say, you know, all you have to do is believe in me, period. And that's all good. But, you know, I'm looking for clues here. And at the end of this chapter, Matthew, the same one with the Sermon on the Mount, he's only time he says really anything about anything like that is right here at the end of Matthew, when it says, and Jesus came and spake unto them, saying, all power is given unto me in heaven and in earth. Go ye therefore and teach all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. So he says, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And I just looked back to see if, you know, like the Sermon on the Mount was being commanded or not, you know, just because it was in the same chapter. It seemed like the Holy Spirit, you know, as the editor, makes that kind of relevant. And yeah, I mean, he says, like, whoever therefore shall break the least of these commandments and shall teach men so, he shall. And that's, you know, he's saying that as a law, and he's commanding them when he says he shall. That is a definite, I don't know, I'm not a linguist, but like a definite article, or I don't know, whatever. But he's definitely saying, you shall, as in he's commanding, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever shall do and teach them the same, he shall be called the kingdom of heaven. I mean, who is this guy that he gets to say he shall and he shan't, and this guy has to do this if he does this? I mean, he says again, you know, I think not that I come to destroy the law or to the prophets, but I come not to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, not one jot or tittle shall in no wise pass from the law. I mean, he's basically saying, you know, he's got control over that, the law. I mean, he's got control over that. He's saying it shall not. I mean, who is this guy? Is he God? Of course he is God. I mean, as again, going back to C.S. Lewis points out, I mean, this guy who said the kind of things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher, as a lot of the Gnostics and other people try to say. He would not be a great moral teacher. He would be a lunatic. No man, a mere man that said the kind of things that Jesus would say is not to be revered as a great moral teacher. He either is what he says that he is God and we should fall down and worship him, or he is a crazy man. But, you know, he's not left it open to us to just say that he's a great moral teacher. He did not intend to. That's a loose paraphrase of what C.S. Lewis says. But, okay, I have one more point here, and I think this may be the best case against what I have to say, but it's not a strong one. And I think that it needs to be said. So I was looking at the end of the Gospels to see what kind of things Jesus was saying after he had risen from the dead, to look for clues in this. And he says here in John, this is in Luke 44. Actually, it's I don't know what chapter it is. It's the it's chapter 24, verse 44. And he says, and this is after Jesus has already risen, and he's like, hey, you guys got any meat? And they gave him some fish and a honeycomb. He's like, being dead makes you hungry, I guess. But anyway, he says, these are the words which I spake to you while I was yet with you, that all things must be fulfilled, which were written in the law of Moses, and in the prophets, and in the Psalms concerning me. Then he opened their understanding, that they might understand the Scriptures. And he said unto them, thus it is written, and thus it behooved Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead on the third day, and the repentance and the remissions of sins should be preached in his name among all nations, beginning at Jerusalem. And so that hearkens you back. So he's saying, these words which I spake to you. Obviously the disciples had a hard time figuring out that he had to die and to be raised up throughout the whole time. There, you know, there's lots of evidences where Jesus is basically trying to tell them, you know, hey, look, I got to die. It's all part of the plan. Just, you know, just kind of go with me on this. I know it's not going to seem right and look good, but trust me, it's good. And so the whole time they didn't understand it. They still didn't understand it. So he's saying here, I guess, these were the words that I spoke unto you while I was yet with you, that all these things must be fulfilled. And what makes me think that it has to do with this, which I'm not sure, but is because he uses the word fulfilled. And so we go back to the verse that we've been quoting here in Matthew chapter 5, when it says, "Think that I come to destroy the law or the prophets. I come not to destroy, but to fulfill." Now there is a very interesting point. Obviously, he came to fulfill the law. That is, again, it's really important to look at a study at what these two words mean, destroy and fulfill, in the Hebrew, or I guess rather Greek. But some people suggest that Matthew wrote in Hebrew, at least originally. But anyway, so he did come to fulfill the law. That is, the 300 prophecies would not be perfect if they were not fulfilled. I mean, the Gospels, prophets and the law were all speaking of him, and unless he had come and done the things that they said, it would not validate and perfect the law, which it was perfected. So if we stop there, then he's right. Then absolutely, I came not to destroy the law or the prophets. I come not to destroy, but to fulfill. Now, even if you're reading that it says he fulfilled it, then nowhere does it say that after it's fulfilled, does it mean that it no longer will exist? I mean, fulfilling in the context meant here in any of the definitions can't mean fulfill means to do away with once fulfilled. And then it continues just to make sure. I mean, it says, "Verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, not one jot or tittle shall no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled." Till all be fulfilled. Okay, now, till heaven and earth pass is a definite thing that he's saying there, and that we can hold on to and say, well, yeah, if we would have just gone with the next line, no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled, then most people could say, well, all be fulfilled could be just referring to the things that have to do with his life, which is reasonable. But just in case, and he does say till all be fulfilled, which, I don't know, whichever way you want to look at that, but he definitely uses till heaven and earth pass as something to prevent us from thinking that the law is gone and that it no longer applies. And, you know, I tried to just use here the things that Jesus said. I know that a lot of people say a lot of different things about the rest of it, but I think it's important to, if that Jesus, you can find out what Jesus meant by the things that Jesus said, and I'm not taking anything away from Paul or the rest of the writers of the epistles, but, you know, we need to find it from here. In fact, I think that such a great case is made from the things that Paul says, that he's saying the same things that Jesus are saying as well. But just from this, I'm just going off of what I can find here. So anyway, I'm going to close this down here, but I just want to just really drive home the fact that I'm still with you 100%. I'm just not convinced of the whole thing. You know, and I think it's important that we test these kinds of things, because we all know that the church in this last days is so corrupted by lies from so many different ways, and we just should make sure that we're not following into them, especially in something that could be of such a great blessing to us. And, you know, as the Sabbath day for one, I'm not saying you should be or become or any kind of religion or whatever. It's just, you know, let's just do what the Bible says. And, anyway, so that was the special edition for today. And, I know that a lot of you probably, weren't, you know, digging the preaching talk, but, you know, my show, I can do whatever I want, right? So anyway, you can reach me for hate mail and the rest of it at chris@conspiracyclothes.com. That's Chris, C-H-R-I-S @conspiracyclothes.com. And you can also go to the website, which is conspiracyclothes.com/nowhere to run. When the name of the show is Nowhere to Run, you can support this show by praying for me to not give out disinformation and to not tell lies to you guys. Because there's just so much misinformation and disinformation. And I just want to thank everybody that has prayed for me. Without it, I would be and have nothing to give, to offer you. I'm sure and convinced of that, that your prayers are the are everything. And so I thank you, and I pray that as you pray for me, you will be blessed for it, and that it would just be right back on you as my prayer. So anyway, thanks for everything, and I will see you guys next week, I guess early next week. Take it easy.